gift for my 30th birthday, and I was terrified of it. Sure, I enjoyed taking pictures, and who wouldn't want to learn how to take amazing ones when there's about to be another newborn in the house? But a DSLR camera is an expensive birthday gift, so I welcomed it with a combination of both awe and terror. How will I ever learn to use it? What if my talent and skill never measure up to the worthiness of this piece of equipment? Surely my husband would regret making such a large purchase. Surely I could learn photography on something far less expensive than this beautiful piece of machinery. I thanked Andy for the gift, then filled my library holds queue with every book I could find on photography. I read up on how to take still shots, motion shots, baby shots. I learned about aperture and bokeh and ISOs. I followed a trillion photography blogs and even took an online course. Over the next year, I learned how to use that camera. Not like a professional, but perhaps like a skilled amateur. I learned not to be afraid of it. I found my groove, and it ended up being the best birthday gift I've ever received. Over that year, I realized that even if I read up on photography techniques, it wasn't until I put the book down, picked up the camera, and went out into the front yard to use it on the going-to-see dandelions sprouting in the yard that I really understood it. It wasn't until I started clicking the shutter with regularity that I saw real improvement in my photos. Experience, it turns out, is the best teacher. The more often I picked up my camera, the better I got. All of those obscure things I was reading about in books like open shade and hair light started to make sense. But they only made sense once they had legs on them. I had to start doing in order to really get the benefits. YouTube videos, online tutorials, and stacks of books would only take me so far. I kept my camera close at hand that year. It wasn't natural for me to take pictures constantly. It wasn't my gut reaction when the light filtered into the kitchen just so, or golden hue fell over the backyard. Instead, I had to set myself up for success. I had to make it easy to grab my camera and start clicking before I saw any real improvement in my photography. Make it easy. Most of us want to make meaningful and lasting connections with our kids. If you've listened this far, I'm willing to bet that you do too. I'm also willing to bet you know that the best way to make those connections is by opening up the pages of a book with your child. Sounds simple, right? And what a relief to know that as overwhelming and intimidating as this parenting gig is, the most effective way to rock it is to simply sit down with our kids and read from the pages of a book. But here's what I know. If we don't make it easy to do, if we don't set ourselves up for success, it won't happen. If I don't put the camera on the kitchen counter and keep the battery charged, I'm probably not going to take as many pictures as I'd like to. And if I don't take a few strategic steps to make read-aloud time easy to pull off, I'm probably not going to read with my kids nearly as much as I hope I will either. If it's not our default to pick up a book and start reading aloud with our kids, then we can be intentional about making it a habit, about setting ourselves up for success. We can make it easy to read aloud more often. Keep it handy. When I discovered that taking more pictures was the key to getting better at photography, I knew I needed to make it more habitual for me to pick up my camera. I didn't set a goal for how many times a day I would shoot photos or how many snapshots I wanted to capture each week. The method I chose was far simpler. Leave my camera out where I would see it often and grab it whenever I could. Every day, I walk by my kitchen counter an untold number of times. It's why my husband's stack of things that are piled up in the corner of the kitchen, which I lovingly and passive-aggressively call the dump station, drives me crazy. I look at it all day. The kitchen counter is probably the busiest, most frequented place in our entire house. It's where I stand to prepare food, gather my thoughts, transition to the next task, open the mail, correct schoolwork, sign permission forms. It's my command center. If I strategically leave my read-aloud book on the counter, there's a good chance I will see it a bazillion times throughout the day. There's also a good chance that at one point or another, I'll end up deciding to read aloud. You know how when you're trying to eat healthier, it's helpful to chop vegetables and keep them ready in the fridge? If the first thing I see when I open my fridge is a pile of celery sticks, I'm more likely to choose them when I'm hankering for a snack. Our read-aloud books are hardly celery sticks, ahem, but the same idea applies. Keep your read-aloud handy so it's easy to grab. You want to see it often. That way you get a constant reminder that this is something you want to get to today. Plunk a few read-aloud books on your kitchen counter in the morning and see if that doesn't inspire you to read a little more often than if the books were tucked away, alphabetized on the bookshelves, or stored neatly in a basket under the table in the living room. Put your books front and center. Keep them handy. Then you don't have to go out of your way when it's time to read aloud because the books are right there. Peg it to your day. Habits are such because they happen without our thinking them through. There is no decision-making with a habit. Every night when I'm getting ready for bed, I flick on the bedside lamp and turn off the ceiling light. I don't have to think about it. I just do it when I enter my room on my way to the bathroom to wash my face and brush my teeth. When I go downstairs in the morning, I don't stand there deciding whether to have coffee that day. Imagine. I just start the coffee pot. It's a habit. If you're convinced that reading aloud with your kids is worthy of your time, then the simplest way to make it happen more often is by turning it into a habit. The best way I know how to do that is by pegging it to something else that happens every day. If you attach reading aloud to something you're already doing every day, the chances that you'll get to that reading time suddenly skyrocket. Melissa Wiley, author of several books, including the lighthearted middle grade novel, The Prairie Thief, said that when her kids were younger, she wanted to read poetry with them. It was hard to fit into the schedule, though, and she found that many weeks they wouldn't read so much as a single stanza. Then one day, she realized that her kids regularly showed up for breakfast, so she hatched a plan. They started reading poetry together while they ate breakfast, and Melissa found that they got to it far more often. It wasn't a habit in her family until it was pegged to breakfast. Then it became habitual, and they began reading more poetry together than they would have otherwise. Jamie Martin, author of the fabulous book, Give Your Child the World, pegged read-alouds to dinner time. While she finished dinner prep, her husband read to the kids at the dinner table to help them wind down from the day's activities and get in a calmer mood. Then Jamie set out the dinner plates and everyone ate and chatted about their days. Jamie or her husband, whoever finished eating first, then picked up the book again and read for another 10 to 15 minutes. Dinner time was already a habit in the Martin home, so adding a read-aloud to it just made sense. It also made read-aloud time happen more often. Meals are a natural peg because they happen every day, and it's usually easy to convince kids to show up when you include food. As a bonus, everyone's mouths are full, so noise can be kept to a minimum, unless you have toddlers, of course, in which case mealtimes may be the worst time of day to read aloud. You can decide what works or doesn't work for your family's season of life, and feel free to change it up as needed. Consider anything that happens with regularity in your family's schedule. A commute to school? A drive to basketball practice? A giant laundry folding session in the afternoon? Peg a short reading session to something that already happens regularly in your family's life, and you'll find that it's much easier to fit in read-aloud time, even on your busiest days. The earlier in the day, the better. One winter, when my oldest three children were 9, 7, and 5, I discovered it was much easier to woo them out of their warm beds if they knew we would start our day with a read-aloud. We'd get up and stagger out to the kitchen in our pajamas to fill mugs with coffee, tea, or cocoa before gathering on the living room sofas to tuck ourselves under blankets and ease our way into the day with a story. That winter, we read The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Caddy Woodlawn, and Justin Morgan Had a Horse. These are some of my favorite memories from that year, cozied up bedheads, starting our day with story and warmth. We've added a few more kids since then, and we don't read aloud before breakfast anymore, but reading early in the day has remained the gold standard for me. I am a more relaxed, pleasant parent if I can get to the most important things in my day early on. Even if the rest of the day goes awry, I'm happy that we got to our most important thing. Plus, I tend to enjoy books more and am willing to read longer if we get to our read-aloud session before I get tired. Record your progress. I'm reluctant to offer this strategy. Why? Because when I see a need for a change in my parenting, I tend to overhaul everything and make a grand plan. For example, I'll decide we should be spending more time out of doors, so I'll look up nature study plans, make a list of possible locations to visit, and rearrange my entire schedule to make time for a weekly hike. Or I'll decide I'm not reading my Bible as often as I should, so I'll make myself a chart, declare that I am now going to get up before dawn to do it, and create an overzealous Bible reading plan. It's rare that this method works for the long term, however. I tend to keep up my new resolution for a day or two, then fail. That's why I'm hesitant to offer mark your progress as a suggested strategy. When I feel my kids need to be outside more, the best thing to do is to tell them to put on their shoes and take them out for a walk, right then and there. When I haven't spent much time in the Word, the best thing to do is pull out my Bible and spend 10 minutes reading from my favorite gospel, John, for the record, on the spot. If you're frustrated that you haven't been reading aloud with your kids more often, what you probably need to do is grab the kid closest to you at this very moment and choose a book from the nearest bookshelf. Then read for 10 minutes. I mean it. Got a kid handy? Try it right now. I'll wait. See, you're a read-aloud parent. You don't need a chart or a plan. You just need 10 minutes and the willingness to let whatever else was on your task list next wait its turn while you spend a few minutes investing in someone who means the world to you. I know there are a lot of human souls who love and are motivated by checklists. I happen to be one of them. That's why I'm suggesting this as a strategy against my better judgment. I get an adrenaline rush from drawing an X on a calendar or chart, from marking something complete, from progress made visible. It is said that Jerry Seinfeld was coaching a young comedian on how to improve his jokes. When the burgeoning humorist asked Seinfeld for his best advice, Seinfeld told him this: write new jokes every day. Mark a big X on your calendar when you write new jokes. He told the comedian to see how many X's in a row he could get, making it a goal not to break the chain. The checklisty among us can do the same thing with reading aloud. We can make an X on a calendar for each day that we read aloud to at least one of our kids for 10 minutes or more. You can actually download a free printable calendar specifically for this purpose at readaloudcalendar.com. I keep that year-at-a-glance calendar on my fridge, and whenever I read for 10 minutes or more with any of my kids, I make an X. Mine isn't an unbroken chain, but it hardly matters. At the end of each year, I see all those X's looking back at me from the calendar, and I know that they add up, that the time was well spent, that I'm a read-aloud mom even when I'm not getting to it every single day. It reminds me that small things matter, that 10 minutes a day add up over time to hours and years, a lifetime spent doing the most important thing. Make a read-aloud shelf. The fourth myth we busted in the previous chapter was this: kids need to sit still while we read to them. The fact is, they don't. Many children actually listen better when they fidget or move while doing focused brain work. I'll bet you know right off the bat which of your kids will benefit most from keeping their hands busy while you read aloud. In my home, all my kids tend to do something else while I read aloud. Some need it more than others, but it's a regular practice at our house to fiddle and doodle while listening. But just having a mental list of things your kids can do while you read aloud isn't enough. Remember my experience with the popsicles and the big kids who were taking forever to come to read aloud time? It helps to keep your read aloud activities in a convenient, easy-to-grab spot. It's frustrating to look at the clock. Notice I have just about 20 minutes to squeeze in some reading aloud before we need to run off to the orthodontist or start dinner prep, and then spend half of that time waiting for my kids to finally join me. It makes for a short, harried, and frustrating read aloud experience. My solution for this is a read aloud shelf. It can also be a drawer, cupboard, or basket, depending on the amount of space you have. On my read-aloud shelf, I keep a set of stackable trays, the kind used in an office, as well as magazine holders. Each child has a stackable tray in which to keep works in progress. If they're in the middle of drawing, watercoloring, or hand lettering, for example, they can keep their work in progress on their stackable tray. Magazine holders are filled with easy-to-grab activities. One magazine holder contains several how-to-draw books, blank paper, and sharpened pencils. When it's read-aloud time, all I have to do is grab the whole magazine holder and call the kids to the table. That gets us into our read-aloud time much quicker and with less fumbling around. Other magazine holders hold watercolor paper and pans of paints and paintbrushes, cutting workbooks and preschool scissors, Usborne reusable sticker books, etc. Just take whatever items you're already planning on letting your kids engage with for read-aloud time and group them purposefully and strategically for quick and easy access. You may even want to give each child his or her own magazine holder. For example, my oldest daughter fills hers with hand lettering worksheets, workbooks, and calligraphy pens. My 12-year-old son prefers to stock his with origami paper and supplies for making paper airplanes. If you do this, you and your kids won't waste precious read-aloud time gathering supplies or trying to think up what to do. Take advantage of a captive audience. Audiobooks, you may remember from Chapter 7, count. The car is an excellent time to play audiobooks. We get a lot of reading aloud in during our 35-minute drive to and from homeschool co-op every week, and we find that road trips are far more enjoyable when we listen to an audiobook together. When I hear the Little House audiobooks, read by Cherry Jones, a favorite in our family, I immediately think of long drives across I-90 in Washington State during the year we moved from one side of the state to the other. The endless Washington wheat fields are married, in my mind, to Pa's fiddle and Laura's harrowing descriptions of the long winter and the town spelling bee. I'll always think of Laura when I'm crossing I-90. I hope my kids will too. In the car, your kids are basically a captive audience. If yours, like mine, tend to squabble on road trips, you'll find audiobooks a welcome reprieve. Either way, you'll get more read-alouds in if you use time you're already spending in the car to enjoy a book together. Books in every room. Research indicates that kids who live in homes where books are plentiful benefit from the mere presence of books. The fact that books are there has a lasting positive effect on our kids, on the way they think about home, how they see themselves, and the role they see books playing in their lives. How a family chooses to spend money says a lot about who they are and what they value. If you want your family to be a reading family, consider letting books make it into your family budget. You can acquire books inexpensively at library book sales, garage sales, and used bookshops. You don't need to fill your bookshelves right away. Owning just a few really wonderful books is better than collecting stacks and stacks of uninspiring cheap books no one feels compelled to pick up. You can also make it a habit to buy your child a book for each holiday and birthday, making books a prominent part of the way your family celebrates. A book allowance can help your children grow their own collection. Each month, my own kids are given a small bit of money to spend on books. They look forward to our trips to local bookshops and keep lists of titles they'd like to acquire. Allison loves the quality of Bloomsbury paperbacks, so when she finds another book in Edie Baker's Wide Awake Princess series, she uses her book allowance to buy it, even if she's read it before. Audrey has used her allowance to build a gorgeous Lucy Maud Montgomery collection. She's always on the lookout for beautifully covered classics to add to her pretty shelves. Two of my kids literally count down the days every time Brandon Mole gets ready to release another fantasy novel. They don't even try to borrow those books from the library. They know they're going to want to have them on our home shelves to read and reread over and over again. These books, purchased with their own money and lining their own bookshelves, become a part of their treasured collections. When they move out as adults, they will take formidable libraries with them. Libraries that will help them remember who they are and where they came from long after they leave home. We send a clear message to our kids when we spend a portion of our family budget on books and when we give books a priority place in our home. We say that they matter, that they are a part of who we are, and that they are a part of our family culture. The Siren Song of Screens. I used to take my iPhone to bed with me. I tell myself I was using it as an alarm clock, and indeed, I would. I would set it down on my nightstand and slip between the sheets, grab my book, plump my pillows, and read a paragraph or three. And then I would remember, I was going to check on that thing. I'll just peek at my phone real quick. 30 minutes later, I'd find myself cruising Instagram with no recollection of opening the app. I'd be frustrated that I'd wasted so much of my reading time scrolling the internet. The phone was just supposed to be my alarm clock. I'm a 36-year-old woman, identify myself as a reader, make reading goals, and have a TBR, to-be-read stack, about a mile high. I have a strong desire to read a large amount each day, and still, I find the siren song of the screen almost impossible to resist. My phone dings, pings, vibrates, or even sits on the nightstand completely silent, and somehow I still feel pulled to divert my eyes and my focus to it. If this is my own experience as a grown woman, how much more enticing must screens be for our children? How much temptation must they face whenever they sit down with a book, or with anything for that matter, that is less splashy, scrolly, or sticky than their screens? Screens are a part of our modern life, and for the vast majority of us, they're here to stay. I know families who ban devices and screens entirely from their home, and if that's you, the rest of this chapter won't be of much help. But if you, like me, want to help your children learn how to navigate a world of screens in a healthy way, allowing for a moderate use of technology and plentiful time for books, then keep listening. Dr. Daniel Willingham compares a book to a watermelon. Juicy, sweet, delicious. His children enjoy a slice of watermelon quite a lot, delighting in its sticky, drippy goodness on a hot summer day. But if they are offered a piece of candy, they will choose the candy over the watermelon every time. Here's where we come in as parents. We can offer our kids candy, the screens, on occasion, but it shouldn't always be an option. Watermelon, a book, itself is a sweet delight that nourishes and is so much easier to enjoy fully when we aren't tempted by candy. By taking the candy off the table at certain times, we relieve our kids of the burden to choose. The freedom we give our kids to enjoy the watermelon comes when their choice to have candy is taken away. Setting limits on screens. Instead of setting certain times of day when screens are not an option, set times of day when screens are. We're just switching the default here. If you set certain periods when screens are not an option, you're actually opening up the rest of your day to being peppered with requests to use them. But try flipping that and making screens the exception rather than the rule. I know families who allow screens only from 2 to 4 in the afternoon or from 7 to 8 in the evening, for example. The rest of the time, the rule is no screens, don't even ask. For the parent weary of hearing, can I watch, or can I play, or one who is just plain tired of seeing a teenager texting friends or scrolling social media, this is a welcome reprieve. If, for example, the rule is no screens except from 6 to 8 in the evening, then our kids are freed from their desire to engage with screens before 6, if only because they know they can't satisfy the desire, and so they might as well do something else. I find rules like this helpful when I'm trying to curb my own use of screens as well. Only you can decide when and how much time is appropriate for your kids to have a screen option. Just realize that whenever screen time is allowed, you are essentially asking them if they'd prefer a slice of watermelon or candy bar. Don't expect your child to choose the watermelon when candy is there for the taking. Our kids won't read much if they have endless opportunities to jump on screens. It's human nature to choose the one that requires less of us, and that is just about always a screen. Putting screen time into limited parts of the day frees up all kinds of hours for other pursuits, reading, I hope, as well as shooting hoops, riding bikes, crafting, playing board games, doing homework, having long, leisurely conversations, engaging with others, and helping around the house. Keep screens in their place, then, by limiting them to certain hours rather than letting them run rampant. all over your child's day. Our read-aloud sessions aren't likely to look just how we picture them in our most idealistic moments. A pleasant, enjoyable reading lifestyle isn't likely to take shape by accident either. But if we set ourselves up for success, we'll stack the odds in favor of our kids growing up to say that some of their most cherished memories are the hours spent reading with their parents. Keep your read-aloud book handy, peg read-aloud time to a regular part of your day, and get to it as early in the day as possible. Mark your progress, if you're inclined to, and make it easy to dive right into read-aloud time by creating a read-aloud shelf where activities are easy to grab. Take advantage of a captive audience in the car whenever you can, and tread carefully when it comes to screens. Remember not to expect your child to choose watermelon over a candy bar. Now, you just need to find a book that will keep everyone engaged. We'll tackle that next. Chapter 9. Become a Literary Matchmaker. I am almost inclined to set it up as a canon that a children's story which is enjoyed only by children is a bad children's story. The good ones last. C.S. Lewis, On Three Ways of Writing for Children. When my oldest three children were small, I couldn't wait to read middle grade novels to them. I enjoyed reading picture books, but they weren't the literature that formed me as a reader in my own youth. Books by Beverly Cleary, Roald Dahl, and Lois Lowry were what sparked my own childhood imagination and turned me into a lifelong book lover. I couldn't wait to introduce these favorite stories and characters to my own kids. In my enthusiasm, I launched into our first middle grade novel a little prematurely when my oldest kids were about 5 and 3. I decided to start with the gold standard in children's literature, and what other than Little House in the Big Woods would do. We struggled. My kids didn't follow the storyline or the long descriptive passages. I found myself bored, and in the end, I felt like a failure because here we were reading our first middle grade novel, a literary gem no less, and we were having a miserable time. What I discovered after that disheartening experience was that not all books are created equal when it comes to reading aloud. I hadn't yet developed my own read-aloud skills well enough to deliver those long descriptive passages in an interesting way. My girls hadn't had much practice painting pictures in their minds and following along with longer narrative. It ended up being a great disappointment and discouragement to me at a rather critical point in our read-aloud journey. Laura Ingalls Wilder has, of course, written some of the best children's books ever published, and since that first attempt, we have gone on to read her entire series 3 times together as a family, mostly through the audio version narrated by Cherry Jones. But there was an important lesson for me in that first failure. Some books read aloud better than others, and some books, even if they are read aloud well, are better saved for the future. I also learned that my own delight, or lack thereof, plays an important role in my family's read-aloud life. We want our kids to read because they love to, not just because they can. We know they won't read much in their free time unless they enjoy the act of reading itself, and so we hope they'll develop a love of books out of sheer delight. That joy, of course, starts with the books themselves. In this chapter, we'll set out with one goal in mind: how to become our own family's literary matchmaker. The goal of a literary matchmaker. Listeners to the What Should I Read Next podcast will recognize the idea of literary matchmaking right away. Anne Bogle, the founder and host of the podcast, practices it regularly with her audience. Anne's method is simple. She asks the show's guest to list a few books they love, one they didn't, and what they've been reading lately. Using that information, she recommends 3 books the guest would likely enjoy. What if we became literary matchmakers for our own children? What if they knew they could come to us to find enjoyable books, not what they should read next to improve themselves, graduate to the next reading level, or meet some academic requirement, but what they should read based on their enchantment with the written word? After all, real adult readers, the kind who read for pleasure in their own free time, of their own free will, read what brings them joy. Where to start? When it comes to choosing great books for your family, the first step is simply knowing where to start. You may feel underprepared to choose rich, excellent books. You aren't swimming in free time either, so pre-reading isn't usually an option. Shortly after that first reading of The Read Aloud Handbook, when Audrey was one, I hoisted her on my hip and descended the long, shallow stairs leading into the public library in the town where we lived. Today, I told myself, getting a better grip on the empty library bag and pushing hair out of my eyes with the back of my wrist, we will get books. I was full of zeal and determination, growing tired of endless rounds of Goodnight Moon and Mr. Brown Can Moo, Can You. The library could solve this, I was certain. I frequented the library often as a child and spent whole afternoons panning the stacks, wondering if it might be possible for me to read every single book in the library's collection. Now I felt out of practice. It had been years since I'd stepped foot in a library. The glass doors slid open. I adjusted Audrey on my hip and breathed in the slightly musty and unmistakable scent of used books. We made our way to the children's department, where I gazed around the room eyeing the worn and faded beanbag chairs, low desks with ivory mouses and giant headphones. I saw picture books, chapter books, and front-facing shelves crammed with easy readers. Oversized stuffed versions of Arnold Lobel's fictional Frog and Toad were posed over the front desk, and a cardboard cutout of Junie B. Jones declared boldly, "Reading Rules." As I scanned row upon row of picture books, their skinny spines jammed one next to the other on what seemed like a million shelves, it hit me. I had no idea where to start. There are some things you feel you should just know, even as a brand new mother. Standing there at the library, feelings of incompetence and inadequacy washed over me. Audrey squirmed in my arms and I set her down, feeling my resolve to bring home a library haul fade away. Surely, I thought, some of these books are better than others. When we read together at home, books by Jan Brett or Tommy DePaola left me thoroughly enjoying myself, the cadence of the text and beauty of the illustrations carrying us through each story, leaving us a little happier to be alive at the end of each book. Then there were the others, the kind I read quickly, skipping entire paragraphs or pages when I could get away with it. They were drudgery to read and bored me to death. What was the difference? What made one book so engaging and the other so dull? And how would I be able to tell which was which in a sea of choices unless I had the time and wherewithal to pre-read them? What is a good book? Before we explore the principles of literary matchmaking, let's talk about what a good book is and what it does. You can become a bona fide book maven in your own right if you can learn to look for two important characteristics in the books you encounter. Good books appeal to all ages. First, a good book appeals to the reader regardless of age. This is the most important thing you should know about good books written for children. They appeal equally to grown-ups. An adult can find herself lost in Narnia as well as any child, and when a parent thinks a book is dumb or trite, there is a good chance that the child hearing the story came to the same conclusion long before. I remember hearing a mother recount taking her son to the local coffee shop for a read-aloud session of one of the Harry Potter books. They sat at an outdoor table and read as cars rolled by and starlings pecked at the ground. As they were whisked off to Hogwarts, they were joined by a complete stranger, a grown man in a bicycle helmet who had just arrived at the coffee shop for his daily macchiato. As he parked his bike and snapped the lock to the rack, he heard the mother reading. "Don't mind me," he said to them, smiling and settling in at an adjacent table. "I just want to hear what happens next." Sarah, a Read Aloud Revival podcast listener, said she put on The Mysterious Howling, Book 1 of Mary Rose Wood's The Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place series, for a long car ride during her family's summer camping trip. "We were having such a good time laughing with the children and guessing at what would happen next that when we arrived at the campground, we found ourselves wanting to drive just a little bit more, she said. We kept finding excuses to sneak back into the car, to find the visitor center, to find the little beach farthest away from our campsite. She laughed. We don't remember much about the campsite itself, but we all remember that story. This is what a good book does. It grabs hold of all of us, adults and kids alike, and doesn't let go. It is equally enjoyable no matter our age, not accounting for taste, which we'll discuss in just a moment. Good books fill the reader with hope. Second, a good book leaves you more grateful to be alive. You close the final pages of the book a little breathless, a little more in awe of the great and glorious world. The book may be tragic, Bridge to Terabithia by Katherine Patterson, moving, A Single Shard by Linda Sue Park, or goofy and nonsensical, The 13 Clocks by James Thurber. Yet it leaves you with a feeling you find difficult to express, amazement at the world, an awe for life, a gratitude for humanity and its quirkiness, its messiness, its vitality. A book that fails to leave the reader with hope has neglected its most important role, to help the reader see the world afresh. Funny books do it, sad books do it, heart-rending or harrowing or light-hearted books do it. They leave us with new vision. They allow us to view the seemingly mundane world around us and the people in it with new eyes. A book should fill us with hope, even in the midst of bone-rattling thrill or heart-wrenching sorrow. Book lists are training wheels. That day in the library, I sat with Audrey on a low plastic chair, reading through a stack of board books someone had left on a kid-sized table. They were boring, not worth bringing home, so I hoisted Audrey onto my hip and headed back to our car empty-handed. I knew what I needed. I needed that book list at the back of the Read Aloud Handbook. As you set out to become your family's literary matchmaker, book lists are your training wheels. They are invaluable to the parent who is learning how to put good books into the hands of her children. To spur a love of reading and fill a home with the best books that can be found, think of a good book list as a sturdy set of training wheels. It'll help you ride successfully before you can do it on your own. It'll become a trusted companion to steer you in the right direction. In the third part of this book, you'll find a book list that I hope will become a trusted companion on your own read aloud journey. I've read every single book on the list, many of them out loud, but you'll also find wonderful recommendations in books like Honey for a Child's Heart and Give Your Child the World, books where the authors have done the hard work of pre-reading, thinking through, sorting, categorizing, and eventually recommending. A good book list is my love language, and if you're ready for a more nuanced list than the one included here, you can find a collection of all my book lists at readaloudrevival.com. Book lists, of course, are always created by a person with unique literary taste, and you don't want to supplant your own opinions and tastes for a book list, no matter how reputable it might be. Use book lists as your training wheels, but once you've acquired enough speed and ability to ride on your own, you can rely on your God-given intuition and the three-question test, up next, to decide which books should make it onto your own family's unique list of favorites. No book list can be the be-all and end-all because just as the members of your family are singular and unique, so will your book choices be. Your list should reflect the beautiful quirks, likes, and dislikes of the people in your family. How to choose books without a book list. The three-question test. What if you don't have a book list handy? Or what if you are trying to decide on a book you haven't seen on any trusted book list? What to do then? It's easy to conduct the three-question test. First, flip open the book to the first few pages and read. You'll need to make use of the sample if you're perusing online. Read a few paragraphs, or a few pages if it's a picture book. Now skip to further inside the book, maybe one-third or halfway through, and read a few more paragraphs or pages. This shouldn't take you longer than a few minutes. You just want a taste. Then quickly answer these three questions. 1. Images. Can you picture the scene in your mind's eye? What you're looking for is text capable of transporting you inside the story so that you can see it vividly in your own imagination. If the book is illustrated, notice if the images capture you and whether or not you want to look at them just a bit longer than necessary. 2. Vocabulary. Do the word choices seem rich and varied? Avoid books with overly simplified or dumbed down language. The best read-alouds contain a wide range of words, the kind of words you want to speak out loud. 3. Curiosity. Are you interested in finding out what happens next? The book probably won't be worth reading if you answer this question with a no. A book doesn't need to pass all three questions to qualify as worthwhile reading. Often, it will only pass 2 of the 3 questions, and that is usually good enough. For example, a book containing no text, as in Peggy Rathman's hilarious wordless picture book, Goodnight Gorilla, or Alexandra Day's Carl books, can still pass the test with captivating images and piquing your curiosity. Sometimes a book's vocabulary is simplified to accommodate beginning readers, as in the case of books by Mo Willems or Sam and Dave Dig a Hole by Mac Barnett and John Clausen. Those books contain rich illustrations and definitely cause readers to wonder what will happen next. The 3-question test isn't fail-proof, but it's an effective and reliable way to decide if a book is worth a place in your family read-aloud pile or in your child's TBR stack. Next time you're poking through the used book sale or clicking through Amazon, put those potential book purchases through the 3-question test and see if it doesn't help you make better choices. Remember, we're looking for vivid imagery, rich language, and something that piques your curiosity. Principles for literary matchmaking. We've covered the 2 characteristics of a good book, the value of book lists as training wheels, and how to use the 3-question test. There are just a few more helpful principles to keep in mind as you play the part of literary matchmaker for your family. Know when to ditch the book. Just as we all have a unique palate and preference for certain foods, we also have a unique palate for books. It's okay for your family to love something another book lover you admire doesn't enjoy. Likewise, it's okay to get bored by something your favorite bookish friend positively adores. Jim Weiss, acclaimed storyteller and narrator of hundreds of audio stories through Great Hall Productions, once told me that the first and cardinal rule of storytelling is that you, the storyteller, must love the story too. The first rule, the unbreakable rule, he said, is you only tell or read stories aloud that you love yourself. If you try to tell a story you don't like, your kids pick up on that and it will fall flat. This is your permission slip, then, to ditch a book that isn't lighting you up, even if it's on all the book lists, even if your best friend tells you it's the best book she's ever read. With so many wonderful stories in the world, you want your family's read-aloud time to be marked with warm and pleasant memories, not overshadowed by a sense of obligation and frustration. I remember ditching The Hobbit when I found myself avoiding read-aloud time. It turns out Rob Inglis does a far better job of reading the book on audio anyway, and my kids still received the countless benefits of hearing Tolkien read aloud. I got to move on to reading aloud Lois Lowry's Number the Stars, which I had been wanting to do for some time. I recently tried reading aloud the award-winning book The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin to my 3 oldest kids. The book was interesting and had a compelling plot, but the quantity of characters and frequent scene changes made it difficult to read aloud. One of my kids was frequently lost, interjecting questions constantly just to keep the facts straight in his own mind. I finally realized I was not looking forward to read aloud time at all, so I let the kids who wanted to finish reading it either read it on their own or listen to the story as an audiobook. For our read aloud time, we switched to something else. Several people have named The Little Britches series by Ralph Moody as their all-time favorite. I read the entire first book aloud to my kids, but found myself counting pages and eyeing my watch through every read-aloud session. When we finished it, I told them if they'd like to read the rest of the series, I'd be happy to get them as audiobooks, but I wouldn't be reading them aloud. I just wasn't enjoying it enough to continue. We simply won't all love the same books. And isn't it wonderful that we are all made just a bit different from one another? Don't fight this. Celebrate it. Ditch what isn't working for your read-aloud time. Delight matters a lot when it comes to sharing books with your kids. Dig around for the right jelly bean. Laura Martin, author of the Edge of Extinction books, which my kids and I find impossible to put down, once said that choosing the right book is like searching for a good jelly bean. Laura said there's no such thing as a kid who doesn't like reading. She recounted her many experiences as a seventh grade teacher and the thrilling challenge of helping kids who didn't enjoy reading fall in love with books. Often, her students assumed that they didn't like reading, but that was only because they hadn't found the right book. It was like tasting a licorice jelly bean and then deciding you don't like jelly beans at all. But licorice is only one flavor. No matter who you are, there's a flavor you'll love. You just need to find the right one. Don't give up then. If you're having a frustrating read-aloud experience, it doesn't mean that reading aloud doesn't work for your family. It's just that you haven't found the right book yet. Dig around for a different jelly bean. It's in there somewhere. Help your child form his or her own reading taste. Bookish people, I'm sorry to say, have an unfortunate tendency toward elitism. I know this because I am a bookish person and also because I hang out with other bookish sorts. In the name of helping our children love what is good, true, and beautiful, and in our zealous desire to put quality books into the hands of our children, we have the very unfortunate habit of disparaging books we've decided don't pass muster. We want to cultivate good taste in literature, yes, but there's a marked difference between good taste and elitism. It's tempting to tell our kids which books they should or shouldn't like, but good taste is acquired over time. It also varies from person to person. God gave each of us unique taste buds, and because of that, we can enjoy rich and varied culinary experiences. I'm convinced that he gave us unique literary taste buds for the same reason. The best way to help our children develop good literary taste is to put lots and lots of quality books in their path. We fill our home with good books and make it nearly impossible for our kids to avoid them. When we read aloud, we choose books that appeal regardless of age and leave us with an overall sense of hope. We choose books with vivid imagery, rich language, and engaging plots. In this way, we give our families an excellent chance of acquiring good taste over time. In Chapter 7, I told you that my oldest daughter devoured light books when she was younger, books like The Babysitter's Club and Cupcake Diaries. We also read aloud a lot of classics together, Newbery Award winners and other books that I knew appealed to a broad range of ages and which would leave us with an overall hope and love for the world and the people in it. She still enjoys reading light books, don't we all? But her favorites are classics written by Louisa May Alcott, Lucy Maud Montgomery, and Maud Hart Loveless. When we fill our children's literary plates with the best books we can find, books that appeal to multiple ages, that leave us feeling more in awe and more grateful than we were before we started reading them, that speak to the human heart through the skilled and lyrical use of words, we spread a feast before them. And what one likes, another may not. That's okay because we have many options. However, it's important to note that we won't get far when we disparage something our child loves. In fact, we may actually do great damage, making a child wonder what is wrong with them because they like something their mother or father thinks is garbage, twaddle, or dumb. Instead, consider the idea that light books end up being like a small bowl of marshmallows on a table set with a grand assortment of more nourishing foods. They don't take away from the grandness or richness of the greater feast. They are simply a small, delightful part of a wide and varied meal. I don't feel loved or cared for when someone disparages or insults my favorite things, and I'm quite sure my children don't either. If we want to cultivate good taste in our children, then we can concentrate on increasing their exposure to good and wonderful books. We allow our children to cultivate their own unique literary taste when we place before them a veritable feast of the best books we can find and then let them develop their own relationship with what they read. You don't have to get it all in. There isn't any book list your children must get through by a certain age to be well-read, well-educated, or ready for the world. Might I repeat that? Your kids don't need to read certain books by the time they leave your home. In fact, we don't want our kids to read every wonderful book while they're at home. We want to leave some titles for them to discover down the road. I first encountered G.K. Chesterton's work in my 30s, and what a joy to find, upon reading my first Father Brown mystery, that I had stumbled upon a treasure trove. Likewise, I never read anything by Laura Ingalls Wilder until I was a mother. Those books have shaped the childhoods of countless children, and yet my first introduction to the world of the Ingalls family happened when I was experiencing them with my kids. What fun it was to first experience the world of Laura, her older sister Mary, and younger sisters Carrie and Grace alongside my children. I sometimes recommend books by Natalie Babbitt to friends, adults and children alike. They are often incredulous after reading Tuck Everlasting or The Search for Delicious. How had I never read these before? They wonder. How is this the first time I've ever read her work? When you find yourself worrying that your child hasn't read a certain book or a certain author, don't despair. Don't try to cram it into the schedule. Think to yourself, with delight, what a joy it will be to stumble across that author or that book or that series down the road. Fill your child's life with good books, but don't worry about getting to them all. Resist the temptation to assign piles and piles of reading out of fear that your child will miss something important. Gaps in our children's reading lives make room for our kids to find and delight in literary favorites during their adulthood. We don't want the best reading our children will ever do to happen all before they turn 18, do we? We want them to be readers for life. Break the rules. Remember your goal. If whatever you're reading is not helping your child love the reading experience, if it's becoming a stumbling block, then change the book. No book list is gospel. You, my friend, know your child better than anyone else in the world, and you have been chosen by God to be his or her literary matchmaker, his or her greatest champion, his or her favorite guide. Even if your child doesn't read the literary giants or encounter the best of the classics, he will remember that you read to him. Trust your instincts. You can ditch or skip any book that doesn't seem like a good fit for your family, or reread a book or series 10 times if that's what your family wants to do. You won't love all the books I or anyone else recommend, so learn to follow your gut and get comfortable making decisions based on your own unique family personality and dynamic. Use the concepts in this chapter to help you choose books your whole family will find delightful, insightful, and thought-provoking. At the same time, never let the guidelines set here or anywhere else override your God-given insight and instincts when it comes to catering to the literary palate of your child. Your goal is for your child to love books and to experience a childhood rich with memories of books shared. Books that delight the whole family, leave them with a sense of hope and awe, and contain vivid imagery, rich language, and an interesting storyline will go a long way toward both. When you become your child's literary matchmaker, you become their ally, friend, colleague, and mentor all at once. By doing so, you make a meaningful and lasting connection with your child. Literary matchmaking is one of our most important tasks as parents who long to connect with our kids and cultivate their reading lives. Chapter 10. Master the Art of Conversation. The books are important, but the conversations they started and the bonds they created are what really matter. Alice Osma, The Reading Promise. Allison set her copy of Shannon Hale's Princess Academy down on the kitchen counter and smiled at me. Finished. I smiled back and asked if she liked it. Oh, I loved it. It was great, she said. I picked up the book and quickly glanced at the back cover. I knew I was going to need to plumb a little deeper to get Allison talking. I didn't really know what to ask, however, so I said, What did you like so much about it?
I don't know, she responded, opening the fridge and taking out a gallon of milk.
Everything, I guess. It was really good.
In hindsight, I realized that by asking her, did you like it, I was inadvertently asking the one question guaranteed to kill any meaningful discussion about a book. It's the question most of us are inclined to ask our kids when they finish a book, but unless we know how to follow up, the question doesn't get us anywhere. Of all the tools in our parenting toolbox, discussion ends up being one of the most important. Anytime we're building a relationship, in fact, discussion is the primary way we get to know and connect with one another. We've all heard about how important it is for families to eat dinner together. Dr. Anne Fischel, co-founder of the Family Dinner Project, states that dinner time conversations are important in order to relax, recharge, laugh, tell stories, and catch up on the day's ups and downs while developing a sense of who we are as a family. Dinner time conversation has even been linked to lower rates of substance abuse, teen depression, and higher grade point averages. When we engage in conversation with our child, when we ask him how his day went, what he's worried about, or what the best part of his week was, we communicate that we are interested in his life and that we have time for him. When we have a conversation with our child about books, then, we communicate that we are interested in what he's reading and thinking about. Without saying it outright, we tell him that it is a priority in our own lives to spend unhurried time with him. Books offer a unique entry into conversation because they contain the best ideas we can possibly encounter. They are, in fact, a gateway to big issues, and we can often enter into a comfortable, leisurely conversation about some of life's hardest topics through the lens of a book. When we read with our kids and then open ourselves up for conversation, we have a unique opportunity to help them encounter great thoughts and ideas, think deeply about them, and allow those ideas and encounters to shape their lives. This doesn't happen in the kind of conversation I had with my daughter about Princess Academy. Asking a child if she liked a book isn't all that helpful. We need to ask questions that plumb deeper, and this takes time. Like all things that make a positive impact on our parenting, we have to prioritize meaningful conversations. We have to communicate love and interest in our kids, and we do this by carving out a bit of time and space to talk with them about life. The good news? Books make this easy to do, and these conversations can fit into our already busy lives. How to talk to your kids about books. When we see a good movie, a good ball game, or a great concert, the first thing we want to do afterward is talk about it, Jim Trelease writes. After my wife and I see a good movie, do you think we rush out to the car, pull napkins out of the glove compartment, and write down the main idea? Honey, what do you think was the theme? That would be ludicrous, right? When I finish a book or a movie that I find particularly moving, I have a strong desire to connect with someone else who has experienced the same book or movie. After reading Catherine Stockett's book, The Help, I called up my friend and begged her to read it as soon as she could. I was eager to discuss my favorite and least favorite characters, talk through the historical context, and contemplate what the author was trying to say. I wanted to share that encounter. The experiences that have the deepest, most profound impact on us are meant to be shared. We are communicative creatures, and we naturally desire to exchange ideas when our thoughts and emotions are stirred. Shannon Hale, the author of Princess Academy, also wrote a book called The Goose Girl. You'll find both of those books in the book list for teens in chapter 15. The night one of my teen daughters finished it, she found me brushing my teeth in the bathroom, getting ready for bed. She burst in and slapped the book down on the counter. "Read this," she commanded, a playful fire dancing in her eyes. You can bet she wanted to talk about it. A wonderful reading experience does that to us. It causes us to reach out to others. We don't want to keep our most wonderful and transformative experiences to ourselves. When my daughter finished Princess Academy, I could have had a meaningful conversation with her, even if I didn't know much about literary analysis, wasn't well-versed in how to talk about books, and hadn't even read the book. It comes down to having an easygoing, friendly approach and knowing the right questions to ask. You can do this without an English degree, Cliff's Notes, or literary know-how. If you love your child and are willing to invest time in learning who she is and what she thinks,